Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Talking About podcast. I am your host, as always, Daniel Olinger, joined by Sean Kennedy. And Sean, we know what's on the people's minds, like we always do. I had a tweet that went semi-viral, so that's what we're going to talk about the entire time today.
I must have missed that. What was the tweet?
So during the national championship, in which Baylor defeated Gonzaga, like, that was already, like, most people thought Gonzaga would win, but not only did Baylor win, Baylor just beat the crap out of them. And basically, like, the scene in Pocahontas where they say, like, the tribe says, these white men are dangerous? So yeah. I photoshopped it, said Baylor to Drew Timmy and Corey Kispert with, these white men cannot defend our guards when switched onto them on the perimeter.
Okay, yeah, I did see that. I must have saw it prior to it going viral.
It has 5,300 likes. I'm serious. I could not believe, like, I thought it might do well. It's like, before this, the most like tweet I ever had was like 200. So
nice.
But yeah,
we both had a good social media week then. I had my Easter tweet about, I'm going to tell my kids that this was the Easter Bunny featuring hip hop. I also got a couple thousand likes on that. So good on a Talking About podcast for getting our clout up.
Yeah, the people's podcast, as they say.
That's right.
But in all seriousness, what we have to talk about today is that the Sixers not only won last night against the Celtics, and due to some scheduling difficulties, we are recording on a Wednesday instead of a Thursday like usual, so you'll be seeing this week's edition of the Talking About Pod a little earlier in your timelines. But
we can tell. I'm going on vacation. So.
Okay, I didn't want to reveal about your personal life, man.
Yeah, I can. Yeah, I'm driving down to Asheville, North Carolina, for a friend's wedding.
Nice.
So it's my first trip that's not just like going to my in-laws or something since the pandemic started. So I'm looking forward to breaking the stir craziness a little bit. And so you readers out there will have fill in guest columnist for the Bell Ringer. I'm gonna miss the 3 games upcoming, and but we'll be back at it next week with this pod, regular scheduled time.
What are the chances that Seth finally gets his bell ringer the week you're off?
I would take that a little personally from Seth. Like, he had to wait till I wasn't analyzing the game closely to finally have his big bell ringer performance. But
a lot of pressure knowing that Sean Kennedy is evaluating you. Maybe he just gets a little nervous.
That's true. You know, they read the mentions. We all know this. So I hope he does by the end of the season, at least. So if he gets it in the next 3 games, all the better.
Yeah, but in all seriousness, we'll finally get into the game that happened last night. The Sixers not only beat the Celtics, they embarrassed them. Like, the final score read 106-96. It might as well have been 166-96, because the Celtics, like, after that second quarter run, like, it felt like they never had a chance. Like, I did not feel – so I couldn't watch the game live, but I had it, like, recorded, so I didn't see any – and I made sure to stay off, like, devices, so I didn't see the result. Until, like, so I got to watch the whole thing, like, you know, without it having it spoiled. And even as the Celtics kind of made a tiny bit of a push in the fourth quarter, I thought they never had a chance. It just, there was no answer for them for Joel Embiid, and it was delightful to see.
Yeah, it's the same old story with Sixers Celtics, where they don't have any possible way to slow Joel down. Time Lord is their new starting center, but he is not the answer. He's too small up against Joel, and he got into quick foul trouble. He eventually fouled out early in the fourth quarter. I think he played something like 13 minutes before fouling out. They threw Luke Kornet out there, which was very comical.
That's a bold strategy, Cotton.
I understood the thinking in that, okay, he can stretch the floor, so offensively that should help us. Maybe it draws Joel out and he's not in there to guard the paint and some of our driving lanes open up. So I got it from that perspective, but him trying to guard Joel one-on-one was one of the funniest things I've ever seen on the basketball court. Joel basically, like, it looked like a teen movie where he grabbed Luke Kornet by the collar and shoved him in a locker. That was the level of dominance, with Joel just stuffing the ball through the rim while Kornet basically watched it. And it was, and then they actually went to Taco Fall, which was, you know, Taco's not a guy that really sees the court that often. And that was like the break glass in case of emergency from Brad Stevens. And yeah, Taco wasn't the answer either. So
the glass was broken for no good reason.
Yeah. The next emergency, they won't have any recourse. But yeah, so Joel got to the line 20 times, 20 attempts at the free throw line. He scored 35 points, made it look really easy. And once the Celtics stopped their hot shooting from three, which was keeping them in the game early, once that slowed down, there was, it really felt like the Sixers were just cruising the rest of the way. And they literally were. It was never within single digits the entire second half. So just a nice, calm, stress-free victory to complete a season sweep over your biggest rival. Like, doesn't get much better than that.
Yeah, I'm someone who really likes Robert Williams, partially because I love the nickname the Time Lord so much. It's fantastic.
It's a good one.
I mean, he just has some really good passing skills for a big, and he's super athletic, and I think he is going to be good. He was not ready for Joel, just way too foul happy. But
yeah,
then you look at it again, like, they didn't – this is why I understand why they made the Daniel Theis trade, to get under the tax line when they basically looked at their team this year and said, you know, we're going to have to kind of rebuild – we're going to have to, like, restock our deck here, because besides Tatum, Jaylen Brown, and maybe Kemba – like, this team, you know, I throw Marcus Smart in there too. This team is not ready to win a title this year, so they have to look forward down the line. But, like, there's a reason the Sixers lost in the playoffs to the Celtics last year. A big part was that Ben Simmons was out, but also, like, I mean, Daniel Theis isn't a Joel Embiid stopper, but I didn't feel like, oh, Embiid has Theis on him, he's just going to feast right now. Like, Daniel Theis is a good player. Daniel Theis, despite being undersized, is very quick, very smart, knows how to use his physicality, has good timing with his hands. Like, that's a guy where I'm like, you know, I do not see Daniel Theis and Joel. Like, if I'm Joel Embiid and see Daniel Theis on the scouting report, I'm like, okay, well, here's what I have to do. Like, here's how I'm going to score. You see this list of Celtics bigs, and you're just like, oh, I can do whatever I want.
Yeah, it's the difference between Joel having certain things that he's going to try and do to be successful and Joel just saying, I can do whatever I want and be successful. First of all, it's embarrassing whenever a team lets financial constraints get in the way of putting their most successful roster forward. So I just want to get that out of the way before I say that when they made the Theis move to get rid of him, to get under the luxury tax, their calculation in their mind was, we're not a contender this year, so let's save this money. And the only downside, because there's really no, it's title or nothing. We're not getting the titles. We're not really worried about the on-court implications too much. The downside is, in 2 years, is Jason Tatum going to remember this and not want to re-sign here? Is that going to hurt our standing with our young stars to the point that, oh, this franchise isn't in it to win? The next 2 years, they could do everything they can to put their best foot forward and show them they are committed to winning, and this won't even cross their mind again. But that is the only potential downside in their mind. So it's definitely hurts them now because they don't have Theis as an option, who, as you said, is a very good player. He, unlike Kornet, he's also a stretch five, but he can actually hold his own somewhat against Joel. He's a bigger body and
he can actually move laterally.
Yeah. So he's a, you know, serviceable option against Embiid defensively. He's, you know, obviously not one of the best defensive centers in the league, but he's fine. And then offensively, he gives you that floor spacing ability, and he's a decent passer. So that goes along with the thinking of trying to draw Joel out of the paint. So yeah, then now they just have no option against Joel, and we saw the result on Tuesday night.
No, we didn't. Other things to mention from that game. I mean, Danny Green right now is, ever since we had our weirdness podcast with AU, man, Danny Green has just been on a tear. It feels like every time he's shooting from three, it's going in. 5-6 from three last night. His only other bucket being that bizarre inbounds turnover from the Celtics where Marcus Smart just dropped it right into his lap and he got a layup off of it. I think the stat they were showing is that, like, since All-Star break, he's shooting around 50-something percent from three.
Yeah, it's like 54% over his last 10 games and on 7 attempts per game.
Jeez.
Which is awesome.
It is very awesome. Danny's playing great right now, looking really good. Danny Green was trending on Twitter last night for positive reasons. Like, that never happens.
It happens more and more frequently. I'll say that. He's having a really good season. I forget who it was on Twitter, but somebody was basically commenting that in the offseason, Danny was viewed as the, like, throw-in wing that we got just to kind of get rid of Horford's contract, whereas Seth Curry was seen as the big acquisition that would really help the shooting and, you know, do a lot of things offensively for the team. And it kind of feels like it flipped. It kind of feels like Danny is the main shooting wing threat now, and Seth is just kind of the secondary afterthought when it comes to those two.
Well, they do a lot of different things, because, like, Danny is, again, prototypical. He will give you threes. He will give you. I mean, I've criticized his on-ball defense before, but he still gives you good defense. Like, he's very strictly 3-and-D. Seth Curry does a little bit. Like, Seth can attack off the dribble occasionally, or when teams, like, chase over against him, he's not a bad passer. But then also defensively, Seth is, again, not the worst defender in the world, but not a strength on defense, pretty much due to his size and lack of, like, elite burst. So they're very different players in that sense. Just wondering off the top of my head, who would you say is, so let's say you're saying the Sixers' best players this season, Joel's obviously number one. I would say Tobias is two.
Yeah, Ben's been so awful post All-Star break that Ben, I would put Tobias back ahead of him. Yeah.
Ben three. Who would you have four, Seth or Danny, if it is one of those two?
I would say Danny. Yeah, that's kind of my point, is that I think Danny's been more impactful this season, whereas going into the season, everyone, I think, pretty unanimously would have said Seth would have had the more impactful season.
Well, sir, you're incorrect, because the correct answer was Paul Reed.
I thought we meant on court. Are you talking about, like, in the hearts and minds of Sixers fans? Because, well, obviously,
that, and, like, whatever per you have to get into, per 48, per 4,800, whatever it has to be, I'm sure Paul leads in that, because he definitely leads in coolest blocks per 48. Because, oh man, that, I love that at the end of the game that he just decided to absolutely smother that one. I can't remember which Celtic player shot it. Someone went in for a layup, and Paul Reed recovered, just sent that thing flying out of bounds, and then just kind of, like, mean mugged him after that.
I mean, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that something Paul Reed did isn't amazing. He does lead the team in G League MVPs. So that's exactly. That's another metric you want to look at.
Doesn't that mean he technically leads the team in MVP awards total at the moment?
He does. Yeah. So I don't know. I can't argue with you then.
B-Ball Paul, friend of Liberty Ballers.
Yeah,
we'll quickly plug that. If you haven't listened to the Gastro Blues pod yet, they had B-Ball Paul himself on for an interview, which was fantastic to hear. So make sure you all go check that out right away.
Get all your Paul Reed content there on the Liberty Ballers podcast network.
I love Paul Reed so much, man. I like all our rookies so much. Like, even if they're not, because especially it helps that the team's so good that we don't have to, like, worry about, like, oh, why aren't they getting better, or why aren't they seeing more playing time? Because, you know, there's none of that, like, where they need to be good right now.
Yeah, it certainly helps that they're not 500 and we're all angry at Maxi for not playing better or something. Yeah, the fact that they're in first and the rookies can just kind of, like, fill in, and every once in a while they have a good game and you're like, oh, that was fun, but it doesn't really matter on a night-to-night basis. It certainly helps, yeah.
Yeah, I still love Isaiah Joe, and he's not a rookie, but new to the Sixers. Rajon Tucker, during that one So when the Grizzlies beat down the Sixers earlier this week, like that was a very just upsetting game. It felt like the Sixers came out completely unready and just were not into it from the start. Grayson Allen made a ton of threes, and that was basically it. The Sixers bench almost got back into the game, and one was just, man, Rajon Tucker can get up. That dude has some springs in his feet.
I have Rajon Tucker thoughts, which I'm going to share in my Fast Five new segment that we're doing later. Ooh. So, yes.
Yes, we are going to be trying out some new segments, one from each of us later in this pod. Actually, you know, is that something we want to do right now? Do you just want to go straight into that?
Yeah, we can do that.
So, yeah, debuting, this is, if you guys do not know, Sean's handle on Twitter is at Philly Fast Break. So, Sean, each week is now going to have Sean's Fast Five. Is that what we're calling it?
Yeah, sure. That's, you know, in honor of the late, great Paul Walker, also, we can call it the Fast Five. yeah, so it's just going to be five quick little stats or observations or whatever you want to term them. But yeah, one of them was Rajon Tucker, and I included in my game recap, it looked like he had flubber attached to the bottom of his shoes. How dated is there? Do you understand when I'm talking about the basketball flubber connection? Do you get the reference, or is that too early?
I'm sorry, I do not, but I did find it funny. It was kind of one of those, like, I assumed it was funny, so I laughed along.
Okay. Well, yeah, it was the 97 Robin Williams flubber movie. They have a whole scene where he basically rubs trace amounts of flubber on the basketball team, like on their shoes, and shakes their hand and gets it on their hands. So they were the team that like never won a game, and suddenly they're bouncing all over the gym and dunking on people. But yeah, Rajon Tucker looks like that. I looked up some of his past exploits. He has a 48-inch vertical. Jeez. He was, which, yeah, that's, that just jumps off the page at you if you read 48-inch vertical. In 2015, he was in the high school dunk contest. He came in second. Derek Jones Jr. came in first. No shame there. Third place, so Rajon Tucker beat this person, which I know Sixers fans will love. Third place was Donovan Mitchell. So Rajon Tucker, better dunker than Donovan Mitchell. Take that, Jazz. We have another one on you.
Print the shirts.
Yes, exactly. so that was one. Another one, Dwight Howard, good some games, makes you shake your head a lot in some other games, had a goaltend over the weekend. I just had to know, how often does Dwight Howard goaltend? He's actually second in the league in goaltends right now. He's tied with Mitchell Robinson with 10. James Wiseman leads the league with 11 goaltends. So that Dwight Howard, so second in goaltend.
That list makes so much sense.
It does.
Like, just intuitively, if you asked me like to guess, I would probably would have gone with like those three.
Yeah, and Wiseman's played like 18 fewer games than Howard, and so the fact that he's one ahead of Dwight, I can't say I've watched a lot of Golden State, but I imagine Golden State fans are very frustrated with.
I watched Warriors Bucks this morning to catch up on some stuff. The Warriors look a lot better whenever Wiseman's not on the court, and he is a rookie. He just turned 20. Definitely not saying he's done. I also tweeted out today what my first two like all rookie teams would be. He was not in my top 12. I think he might be good one day. I just don't, it's not a Warriors podcast, so.
It's tough with young big men. Young big men, the school of thought is that big men take longer to adjust to the NBA game than guards do. So it's not unexpected.
Imagine just being some random NBA fan for some reason, checking out a Sixers podcast, and now in back-to-back weeks, I've gone after DeAndre Ayton and James Wiseman. I am attacking young bigs who are not producing.
You're coming for them.
Exactly.
All right. So that was number two. Number three, we saw a lot of Ben Simmons post-ups recently, not all of them super successful. I just wanted to check where the Sixers are. They are leading the league in most post-up possessions at almost 11 per game, 10.9 per game. So that's not unexpected. And of course, in large part, thanks to Joel and also Tobias, I would say, they're fourth best in points per possession on post-ups at 1.03. That doesn't really look great when you're thinking about points per possession in general, but you got to think the post-ups are happening when the half court has bogged down. You don't really have a better option. So that's still pretty good offense, I would say.
It's acceptable. It's definitely not bad, I would think.
Right. All right, that's 3-4. Sixers are awesome in the clutch this year. They're leading the league in winning percentage in clutch games. They're 20-6 in such games. So best in the league in clutch. I think that kind of speaks to Tobias. Tobias has been the closer all season long. And we saw last week he had a big game where he was the closer. I think this is a big departure from the past when I think a lot of people put this on Brett Brown's shoulders. There was always the, oh, you know, didn't make the late game adjustments and they lost a lot of games down the stretch that people thought they would win. They're actually best in the league now. So I think that goes to Tobias being the closer. And you got to give credit to Doc Rivers for, I think he's been a little more flexible in his late game lineups, where if we talked a lot about Danny having a great year, but there's have been games where he's been completely off, but Doc hasn't been afraid to bench him and put in Shake or someone else that's having a really good game. So I think that's credit to Doc there.
No, there's definitely it's great that the team's winning that many close games. The other side of it is that they're in a lot of close games that shouldn't be close games, playing sub 500 or around 500 teams and, you know, letting them back in the game, not just blowing them out, where it's I remember correctly, I don't think the prime Golden State Warriors had incredible clutch records, but that's partially because they almost were never in clutch games. They were basically just killing everyone, which is kind of preferable, but it is still nice to see that, like you said, just I can't believe we're at the point of both Joel and Tobias where Joel he'll take one dribble to his right and fade for a 17 footer on the baseline. I think, oh, that's going in. Or Tobias will back someone down for 8 seconds, turn over his shoulder, fading at some weird angle. And again, I think when it leaves his hand, that's probably going in. It's just amazing. That's where we're at right now.
They're truly the masters of the mid range. And I feel great about it. Yeah, you're right. You just feel so confident when those shots go up. It's a nice feeling. All right. So number 5, just Joel's free throws in general. It came to mind because of that amazing post-game interview he had with Reggie Miller, where Reggie was trying to compliment him for going 16 for 20 from the line. Mm-hmm. And Joel was just immediately like, oh, that's not good. I got to shoot 90%. I'm pissed. I love that. I love, also, I wanted to note that my wife, who was watching the game with me, not a huge Joel person, doesn't like his braggadocious stuff that really turns her off, but absolutely loved his comment about free throw shooting. She's very much a you got to make your free throws, and if you don't make your free throws, then what good are you on a basketball court kind of mentality, those people.
Well, you should just tell her about Andre Drummond then, and then she can bond with Joel Embiid over a mutual dislike of Drummond.
I'm sure if she knew Andre Drummond and his game, she would absolutely hate him. So, but yeah, that was great. And then the Stat Muse stat came up on Twitter that Embiid at 11.8 free throws per game is only behind Shaq and Wilt in NBA history for free throws per game in a season. So that's pretty incredible. It's nice to have your star player get such hyper efficient offense like that. It's makes it a lot easier to have success on the offensive end. So good for Joel, striving for better, but what he's doing right now is pretty awesome too.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Well, that was a great way to debut Sean's Fast Five. And we'll just go straight into my segment because your last point basically hit what I was going to touch on. I'll go a little more in depth on it. So my segment is going to be called Danny's Corner, in reference to the one and only Danny Green, who loves those corner threes. I'm fine being called Dan. I'm fine being called Daniel. I have always refused being called Danny in my life because that is my dad's actual name. It's not a nickname for him. His actual name is Danny. And, you know, it's like a weird thing where I never wanted to be called it. But and to play off something that Darren Revelle once tweeted, I feel bad for myself, but it's tremendous content.
So your dad, much like Jimmy Butler, he's literally Danny.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
I am not literally Danny, but, you know, Danny Green goes, that's what it says on the stat sheet. So we're just going to roll with it like that. So for my first ever segment of Danny's Corner, I'm going to talk about Joel's free throw shooting, but more importantly, the way Joel goes about getting those free throws, it is ruthless. And he is so mean to other teams in getting them. I loved last night how it seemed like he didn't just want to beat the Celtics. He just wanted to, like, demoralize them from the start. Like you mentioned, Taco Fall checked in. Everyone gets excited. Oh, it's Taco. Like, maybe another center in the league thinks, oh, I'm just going to try and bang into him, you know, because it's kind of like it's like waving the red flag in front of the bull. Here's the 7'5 dude. Can you go post up on him? Joel, first possession down when Taco checks in, catches the ball in the mid post. What is Taco has size on him, but what he doesn't have is he has much less experience and he is not nearly as quick. Taco puts his hand near Joel. Joel rises up, gets the foul call right away, two free throws. I'm not sure how many centers in the league are as smart or willing to just always go to that. He has never felt bad about being a foul drawing master. You know, like, I feel like there's a lot of built-in, like, sentiment that, oh, these centers have to be tough. They have to back down every time. They have to do this. They have to do this. And Joel just realizes, if these guys put their arms near me, I'm going to rack up foul shots, and that's going to help our team win. And he does it every time. Some of the numbers on Joel, I mean, it's just insane. Like, 100th percentile in on-off splits for free throw rate, which means when he's on the court for the Sixers, they have a 29.5% free throw rate. Drops all the way to 18.9%, which is around league average when he's off the court. But when it's him on the court, they're league best. He takes 17 free throw attempts per 100. That's ridiculous. In 33 games this season, he's only had 11 games with under 10 free throw attempts. And in six of those, he played fewer than 30 minutes. Going back to how I loved how he just wanted to dominate the Celtics, two highest free throw performances of the season, 21 free throw attempts against the Celtics all the way back in January, and then 20 free throw attempts last night. And it's just so pleasing to see that he doesn't care what other people think. He's going to keep doing this. He's going to keep embarrassing other teams, racking up fouls on them. When the Celtics tried to get back in it, he did the same thing again last night. You know, Luke Kornet thought that wasn't a foul, but guess what, dude? You put your arms anywhere near Joel, his arms are going up. He's got quick reaction time. He's strong, and he knows how to draw that contact, knows how to get the refs to see it every time. And I also loved, like, this isn't about the free throws, but speaking to how ruthless he was, he did the same move he did to Mo Wagner in the Wizards game where he got injured, where Wagner overplayed him to his right and Joel just drove left and punched it on him, that he did the same thing to Luke Kornet, where Luke Kornet was just sitting on his right hand, sitting on it entirely, and then just one hard jab step right, dribble, and absolutely just flushes it through the hoop. It's incredible. And I think another important thing about it is that the Sixers, as we all know, do not take a ton of threes. It's never been their forte. They are 27th in three-point attempt frequency, which usually you would think that's a big hindrance, and it can be. But the other most efficient thing that the Sixers do, I mean, the other most efficient thing that in modern basketball is getting to the foul line. And because of Joel Embiid, largely, the Sixers lead the league in free throw rate. So for that week, that ends this week's Danny's Corner. Joel Embiid is a ruthless foul drawing monster who will do the same move over and over again. He does not care what the other teams think, about how opponents think it's cheap, about how predictable it gets. He will do it every time until they figure it out, and no one can figure it out right now, and I love it.
It's he just does the same thing, and he's, like you said, he doesn't get bored. Like, it's like when you used to play Madden and you had a play that worked every time against the computer, but you wouldn't do it every time because you're like, oh, that's not fun. Like, I want to try to do something.
I ran slants down the whole field.
Okay, so no wonder you appreciate Joel's propensity to go to the same thing every time.
Find an answer, man.
Yeah. But I think you said this. It's like, why should I change what I'm going to do? It should be on the defense to figure out how to stop me. Like, the onus should be on them. Like, if I have something that works, I'm going to keep doing it. And yeah, it's working. So keep doing it, Joel.
So let's see, what else can we touch on here? The Sixers later this week, they will play the Pelicans Friday.
Pelicans on Friday. Yep.
Pelicans on Friday. Hopefully Zion will be playing, because that'll be an interesting matchup between the Sixers and the Pelicans. Just, again, it's not like the immovable force meeting, was it unstoppable force meeting the immovable object? It's more like two unstoppable forces just ramming into each other. Like Joel, Zion, and you could even throw like some, I guess Ben's been more stoppable lately, but specifically Joel and Zion.
Joel or Ben would be the immovable object in this scenario, I think.
Sure.
Given his defensive strengths. Yeah, do you think they would guard each other, or would that be more of like a Ben assignment?
I could see Ben. I think they're going to put Joel on Zion, actually. They do like to start Steven Adams. So I guess it will be Ben on Zion. I mean, the other option then would also be Toby, because Toby's really strong, but you do need someone who's explosive to hang with Zion. Just not just like stay in front of him. It's just like, because it doesn't matter if Zion gets around you. If he can just get up quicker than you, you're done. So that'll be interesting. But conversely, I mean, I don't know who Zion. Zion probably has to guard Toby, just because anyone with like movement skills is a terrible matchup for Zion, because he is just not quick of foot on the defensive end, nor does he have a great understanding of what he's doing out there. So like, I could see Ben just blowing by him if they set a few ball screens, whereas at least Toby, he knows like, this dude's just going to try and post me up, and I at least like can make that point of contact pretty easily.
Yeah, it would be a lot more of Tobias coming off pick and roll and doing his little floater game in the lane. I don't think they would try to post up Harris against Zion. That wouldn't seem to be the best way to attack that.
Mm-hmm, for sure. I mean, I still feel like the Pelicans have been really weird this year. I haven't caught too many of their games. I probably need to see more. It'll be good to see them for the first time. Obviously it didn't happen last year. I used to love whenever the Sixers would play the Pelicans, because Joel Embiid is long, kind of owned Anthony Davis in their one-on-one matchups. So that was always a pleasant sight. I mean, Steven Adams, I think Joel should be able to. I mean, Steven does present some problems that he's strong enough to hang with him. They've also been playing Jackson Hayes more recently, who's a talented young player, started to put some things together, but don't know if Jackson would remind me of like Mike. I could definitely see Joel Embiid getting someone like Jackson Hayes in foul trouble pretty quickly.
Yeah, for sure. That would be like a pump fake, and Hayes would bite, and Joel would just like already start walking into the free throw line before the whistle even blew.
It'll definitely be an interesting game, because the Pelicans, like, I don't have the stats in front of me right now, but in the past month or so, they've been like first in offense, dead last or so in defense. So it'll be wild.
Yeah, and they're a young team, so that's kind of to be expected. Offense usually comes a little quicker for young players than figuring out a defensive scheme. I feel bad for Nova guy Josh Hart, who's now out for the season with a thumb injury. He had really been playing well. And I guess we'll see if Brandon Ingram's able to suit up Friday. He missed his last game. He's questionable to play tonight against Brooklyn. So who knows if he'll be back on the court by Friday or not. But yeah, Zion did play in their last game, so I'd expect him to definitely be out there on Friday, which it'll be fun to get to see him. He's playing like everyone thought he could. It looks looks tremendous, and I'm curious to see how the Sixers go about devising a strategy for slowing him down.
I'm trying to think now. One interesting thing in the game is we're so used to Matisse doing just incredible things on the defensive end of the floor when he checks in. I don't know what he does against the Pelicans necessarily, because he obviously is way too wiry to guard someone like Zion. But the Pelicans guards are not really, I mean, like Lonzo's been shooting better from three this year, but I still think he's more of a catch and shoot guy than a off the dribble shooter. Eric Bledsoe, you're usually very welcome to let him shoot. Like, could you play Matisse on Brandon Ingram, or is there like, does Ingram present limits to like how tall he is with a long wingspan that Matisse can still bother him like that? It's just interesting because Matisse is such an important weapon for the Sixers on the defensive end.
Yeah, I think he could guard Ingram. I don't think that would be the best matchup for him, but it's not like Ingram's a super strong guy where his height would take him down on the block and really do damage. I think Matisse could hold his own in the strength department, but yeah, you're right that Brandon is a very long person, and shooting, he might be able to shoot over Matisse a little bit easier than most guys can. But I think the chase down blocks from behind that Matisse does, that would probably still be able to get those, just because the angle from coming at from behind like that, I think he could get it on the way up on Ingram's release point. But yeah, I mean, the Pelicans have plenty of guards you can stick Matisse on. Alexander Walker, you know, Kira Lewis, a lot of those smaller guards that Matisse might be an option to have on them too. So we'll see. That's a good thing about Matisse, is he's so versatile that you can kind of stick him one through four in a lot of nights, and he can fill in where you need him to.
Mm-hmm. Sticking Matisse on rookies is just straight up mean. Like, I think it was the Cavs game that the Sixers won where, like, Broderick Thomas, I think, checked in, and like first play of the game, he tried to shoot for his first play and he tried to shoot a three, and Matisse just jumped from like the free throw line and blocked it. Like, that is just going to be nightmarish. That you come in there and you think, okay, I'll get some buckets, show the coach what I can do, and there's this weird octopus man running around the court trying to get his hand on every basketball. One thing I just thought of, it'll be like a little interesting micro thing to watch in the Pelicans game. Steven Adams is notorious for being a devastating screener, and Matisse's whole thing is like, he'll duck back, work around the screen, end up trailing this guy, but he's managed to avoid the contact, stay close enough that he can still do his incredible chase down blocks and like poke steals. Like, who wins that battle between Matisse, expert screen navigator, and Steven Adams, the man of steel?
I'm never going to go against Steven Adams in any kind of physical altercation.
Point is, like, can Matisse avoid making it physical? Can Matisse get around him first before he makes contact?
It's going to be tough. Adams is, as you said, an expert in that area. He's a guy that can be a positive offensive player while shooting three times a game, just because of his ability to free others and his work on the glass. That'll certainly be something interesting to watch if Matisse can get around those, as well as Ben. You know, Ben's going to be chasing some guys on the perimeter, and he's obviously, he's a big body himself. So
although just any kind of hard screen, as Facu Campazzo taught us, any hard screen is
yeah, that was an embarrassing moment for Ben.
I think he got fouled on that. I think he leaned in pretty hard.
Do you? I don't know.
Like, Ben was running full speed, and I thought, like, when I was watching that Sixers game, I thought, like, I generally like Campazzo, but he felt like he was almost trying to hurt Ben on some of his plays. There are other plays down the court where he was like just throwing his shoulder into him, like pretty like dangerous positions. I thought it was a little cheap.
Maybe that's just that Euro ball, you know.
Regardless, the optics are bad.
Yeah, they get a little grimy with that kind of stuff.
What was I going to say? Also, like, we were talking about Matisse there. Just another play I remember from that Celtics game last night. It was, I don't know if you remember this play. It was either the second or first quarter. I think it was in the first quarter, like midway through. Boston had them in rotation and they were all closing out, like the kind of play where if the Celtics had finished, it would have been those like basketball is beautiful clips you see where pass here, everyone getting like another Sixer defender flying by closer. They look like they're going to get an open layup out of it. Then Matisse just running around the court, tracks it down. And, like he once Smart threw the dump off pass on a bounce pass, like trying to get the dunk. Matisse got his hand in there, deflected it, and got a steal. And it's just incredible to watch how he's developed from a guy where we were starting to get a little unsure of him towards the end of his rookie year and the start of this year. And then now, like Matisse around the league is just respected as one of the best defenders there is. And someone you have to know about in the scouting report is he's going to come in and just ruin your offense sometimes.
He's really is incredible at everything he does on that end of the court. Do you think he could get a second team all defensive slot this year?
It's so hard because people wait, like, understandably they wait that like you have to play a certain amount of minutes, and how much overall impact can you have when you play less than half the game? I will say there was a great article on premiumhoops.org the other day. I believe it's .org. I hope I'm not getting it wrong, but Premium Hoops, where Cody Hudak, a good friend of mine, he wrote about why he was writing this whole piece on how you should properly evaluate defense, be like assigning certain plays to great plays, good plays, like acceptable plays, and then big mistakes. And basically he goes through all of that. And at the end, his conclusion is that Matisse Thybul is the best perimeter defender in the NBA right now because of what he does in terms of like just he makes so many outlier great plays that really matter for a defense. Obviously, it's still like centers impact defense the most because rim protection is king. But if you're just talking about perimeter defenders, a lot of it is like, can you really disrupt the other team's offense? And Matisse is just, he's a disruptor. No one wants to go near Matisse.
That's an interesting way to look at it. It seems like whenever Matisse makes one of those outlier plays, it's like, oh, a block from behind, and then suddenly the Sixers have a 3-on-1 run out. Or
because he also saves them like incredible. Like most guys cannot save those blocks like he does.
Right. Yeah. Or he'll jump a passing lane and suddenly he is the dunk, uncontested dunk on the fast break. So they're kind of like 4-point swings in a lot of cases. So it's like a shutdown corner who has this great propensity for getting pick six plays or something. And how much value that adds to your team. But you said originally in our Matisse discussion that, you know, he's a guy that's on every team scouting report. And that's just so rare for, you know, a bench player that teams always have to be aware of when he's coming in, where he is on the court, and to have to game plan around that. So that's why I think it is possible. I think he's already kind of garnered that reputation. So even though he does play, I don't know what the number is exactly. I can probably look it up real quick, but like 22 minutes a game or whatever he plays.
I would wager it's a little less than that, but regardless, it's not 24. It's less than half.
Yeah. I'm just going to take 5 seconds and look it up. Okay. It's actually less than that. It's just over 19 a game.
Yeah, that's what I would have guessed around there.
Okay, so he's playing under 20 minutes a game, but he's on people's minds a lot more than any other person in the league who only plays 19 minutes a game. And I think if you look at the advanced metrics and you do kind of the analysis like you just talked about, he will across the board come up as one of the best defenders in the league. So I'm just kind of curious how much that will play into it. And obviously, you know, being on the court is a big factor as well. So it's going to be something interesting to keep an eye on in the postseason awards situations.
I mean, it speaks to why the Sixers are so good. They have a guy who's in the defensive player of the year conversation, another one who could get a first or second team all defense in Joel, and then probably another one who has rightfully earned all defensive team consideration despite being a bench player, Matisse Thybul. And then on top of that, like above average defenders in Danny Green and Tobias Harris, like, and that's six of their top seven.
Yeah. And
or five.
We have to throw plaudits Tobias Harris's way for you just said above average defender Tobias Harris, and I said, yeah, that sounds right. And I don't think past seasons anyone would have, made that claim. So I just think it's another area where Tobias has really improved, and he deserves credit for that.
I mean, I'm not sure how much of that is improvement as that he's guarding what he should be doing, which is he might be a little shorter than some people he guards at times, but he's like super strong. So he can hit, it's like how he can always handle big guys like Marc Gasol inside because he is really strong. He was just more vulnerable to quick guys, which with Al Horford on the court, he really didn't have the option of who he could guard in that sense. Now being able to guard like more physical, like guys who are interior threats, he's really good at that. So that's all fine. But yeah, Tobias has never been a 70. I think he's been fine this year. So, I mean, it's all pretty great. One last thing on Matisse, though. Is it better that the Sixers accidentally did leak that information to the Celtics? Because I know the optics all look bad that the Sixers had to give up the 33rd pick to then go up and get Matisse. But now knowing that the trade ended up being the Sixers get Matisse, the Celtics get Grant Williams and Carson Edwards, who are both worse than Matisse Thybulle, and now Celtic fans get to know they don't have Matisse. Does that make it better?
So you're saying it's better because Boston fans have this knowledge that they were in on Matisse and didn't get him. Whereas if that hadn't happened, they would have just been like, oh, we took someone at 20 and someone that fell later ended up being a better player. But who knows if the team was even in on him? Is that what you're saying?
Something like that. But it could also be that Boston fans, they love knowing that they outsmarted another team. They thought they did it to the Sixers again that night, but even if they did, it really didn't work out for them. Because I mean, sure, maybe the Sixers could have picked someone else besides Carson Edwards at 33 who would have helped them, but like the Celtics ended up with a guy who, I think Grant Williams is good, but he's not as good as Matisse. He's so far just a bench big you can occasionally throw in there. Carson Edwards has just not gotten to it yet, and Matisse is, like you're saying, already deserving of all defense considerations in his second year, and that's the guy the Sixers got instead of the Celtics.
Yeah, I'm still gonna say that it wasn't a good thing that got telegraphed. Well, I think it would have been better if they just took Matisse at 24 and still kept the second round pick.
Well, I don't think it's a bad thing. I think anymore. I think it's just a neutral thing. Well, just neutral.
Okay. All right. It's been upgraded to neutral in your mind.
Yeah.
I think Matisse turning out to be as good as he's been just makes up for the fact that it was a really stupid thing to happen.
Yeah. It's like that's an acceptable mistake now. Acceptable. Because they still got a net positive for their team.
All right. I'm not going to agree with you on this one, but
it's like a
I do agree that Matisse is a great player, and I love having him on the team. It's a
galaxy brain take. I'm just trying to figure out more ways we can, like, there are just tally up all the things in which the Sixers have now bested the Celtics.
We have enough. They swept the season series. Boston is under 500. There's all these Brad Stevens going back to college rumors. There's enough things tilting the Sixers' way in this rivalry right now. I don't think we need to relitigate the fact that telegraphing your pick in the draft is dumb.
Oh, man. Well, Sean, I think that's going to wrap it up for us this week. Hope you have a safe drive down to North Carolina, man, and a good break. And yeah, it was good talking to you again this week.
Yep, good talking to you. Hopefully the Sixers can rack up a few more wins in my absence from the site this week, and everybody stays healthy, and we'll come back at it next week and see if the Sixers and can kind of hold off Brooklyn. And that's going to be the storyline the rest of the season, is them flip-flopping at the top of the conference.
Seth, if you're listening, prove Sean wrong and win that bell ringer.
Do it. I didn't say he no. couldn't do it.
No, Sean,
I hope he does.
Lies. Sean has said that he couldn't do it.
All right. Yeah, I hope he does. Go do it, Seth.
All right. See you next week, people.